Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. We are joined today by Igor Grossman, who is an assistant professor of psychology and the director of the Wisdom and Research Lab based at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. His main research interest is the complex processes that enable individuals to think and act wisely. He has also done pioneering work on the development of wisdom in different cultures and was named one of the 2015 rising stars in the field of psychological science. He recently co-wrote a paper with Alex C. Hoon and Phoebe Ellsworth entitled Emotional Complexity, Clarifying Definitions and Cultural Correlates, in which certain common, especially Western assumptions about having mixed feelings are challenged. Hello, Igor. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, Igor. Well, could you begin by telling us maybe a little bit about yourself, Igor, and how you became, first of all, how you became interested in this field of work?
Well, there are two different ways to answer this question. There is a pragmatic one, and the answer is very simple. I came to Michigan at that time to do a PhD, and my advisor at that time, Richard Nisbet, was interested in merging the fields of cultural psychology and the field of wisdom, which was existing in developmental psychology. So I was challenged to a task to create such a merge and see what are the parallels and how can we proceed and what would be the best way to develop a reliable way to measure wisdom, for instance, and so on and so forth. So sort of start looking into that. But more theoretically, and particularly the work that you referred to about emotional complexity, I was just struck sometimes later after I already got my PhD with that there is a sort of dichotomous view in lay beliefs, at least, of emotions in the West, yeah. North America and in Western Europe. So it's like it's either you're either good or bad. It's a black or white. But at the same time, we know in emotion research that it's much more complex than that, and then cultures may vary. So that's where the motivation to study this, the notion of emotional complexity, came about.
Okay, well, could we just, for the listeners then, just try and unpack that term a little bit, emotional complexity, and how it is generally understood?
Well, the definition of emotional complexity is complex. In the sense that, and that was also the interesting part that we got attracted to it, and many different ways to conceptualize it. Yeah. Some definitions, it's the idea of mixture of your emotions. Do you experience multiple emotions at the same time, or is everything just either good or bad? Yeah. So do you clearly differentiate between those two, or do you see also shades of gray? And there are other definitions, though. They also talk about emotional complexity. And in those definitions, about how well are you able to differentiate between, let's say, different shades of negative emotions. So instead of feeling just bad and everything at the same time, like anger, sadness, frustration, well, is this situation more sad than angry and that situation more angry than frustrating? And so some people vary in that too. So what I try to do is like try to integrate these different perspectives together and try to understand empirically what is the relationship between them and what is the relationship between them across cultures.
Okay, just to clarify that. So say, for example, I got a new job in another city. So I'd recognize that I was excited by the job, while at the same time perhaps seeing that it could generate anxiety in myself and also maybe a touch of sadness because I'm leaving a place I like and I'm going to miss friends, and being able to sort of recognize all those emotions.
That's right. So that would be sort of one example where a more emotionally complex person or emotionally complex experience would be characterized by this diverse representation of various facets of your emotions, emotional life. And in contrast, the person who would not be able to do that would just say, this is either all great or this is just all bad.
What have earlier studies of emotional complexity indicated, especially with regard to, you know, the ability to control one's emotions?
So there are different, as I said, like there are different traditions.
Yeah.
And some of those traditions looked at the clinical populations and non-clinical populations, as well as sort of non-clinical populations that varied in degree to which they're able to regulate the emotions. And by regulating the emotions, what they meant is that you are able to see the positive in the negative and the negative in the positive. So quite often, kind of similar to the idea of emotional complexity in the first place. When researchers talk about emotion regulation, they quite often differentiate between a maladaptive, at least for North Americans and Western Europeans, a suppressive tendency. So you just suppress everything. That doesn't work very well for British people or for Germans or for Anglo-Americans. And the tendency to reappraise, and this is the term that is used to describe an experience in which you focus on the positive aspects of the possibly negative experience at the moment. And that tendency apparently is adaptive. So it helps you to regulate, it helps you to calm down, but also work through the adverse event. So it turns out that the people who are able to differentiate the emotional experiences, they are better able to reappraise. And it also turns out that this is this earlier studies that people who are able to differentiate are less likely to be the depressed individuals. So clinically depressed individuals, they cannot that well differentiate between different facets of the negative emotions. For them, everything is just black.
That's very interesting. So, and that runs somewhat counter to a common assumption in certainly in Western countries that mixed feelings are often associated with indecision and wishy-washiness. You're actually saying that if you're able to differentiate, then you're more stable in a sense.
Yeah, to some extent, I mean, like the emotion theorists right now, at least some of them, including those in Europe, think that many emotions help you. They provide information about how to react to a situation. So maybe it's about how to behave in a certain situation. Maybe it's about how to reflect on a certain situation. That aspect is not really clear. But what is clear is that emotions send you signals. And so the more different emotions you have, the more signals you have that prepare you how to act possibly or how to think about certain events. And if you just consider them all into this kind of dichotomous categories of black and white, that is not very adaptive because you will not be prepared, or you will become very rigid.
Yeah.
And instead of that, you want to be rather flexible. So from this theoretical perspective, that many emotion researchers in psychology and cognitive science philosophy would agree with, it seems like it makes perfect sense to have multiple experiences. It's just that somehow North American and Western European cultures tend to push people in somewhat different directions in the last few hundred years.
Okay, well, let's come to your project now. What were your main aims with the particular research that you did along with your colleagues?
So what we were interested in, on the one hand, what is the relationship of different sort of modes of being complex? So for instance, a mixture of positive and negative, is that in any form related to the ability to differentiate within positive or within negative? Yeah, that was one question.
Yeah.
But the big picture question was, well, there's some work that suggests that people in, let's say, East Asia, particularly in Japan or Hong Kong or China, mainland China, more likely to report mixed feelings than their North American counterparts. And quite often it was sort of presented as kind of dichotomous fashion. There's this East versus West.
Yeah.
And that's not very satisfactory because if you have only this kind of dichotomous you cannot really understand what could be the driving force behind these differences.
Yeah.
So you can say, well, okay, this may be because they eat with chopsticks and those eat with forks. That would be equally plausible explanation than to say that this is something else. So you need many more sort of countries that would possibly be controlled in terms of language, because language can enforce how you express yourself emotionally, in terms of socioeconomic status, and many other factors. And then you actually need to measure some of those processes. So what I try to do with my colleagues in this paper, we try to understand how these different forms of complexity vary across a large number of societies, a large number of countries.
Yeah.
And what are the possible underlying processes? And there are two that have been discussed in the prior research. One is this idea of, well, having this kind of epistemological beliefs about the world.
Yeah.
And that people in East Asia, they, similar to the chopstick idea, that they are more likely to think in terms of yin and yang. So they are more dialectical. And people in the West, they're just more linear. And this is a great idea, but there is actually not that much conclusive evidence, again, for this idea from prior research.
Just to clarify that, when you say dialectical, are you saying that when there are two opposing ideas, then they, if you're dialectical, you see them as sort of complementary in a way, whereas linear is more that you see them as more opposed?
That's correct. So that that you would be, well, there's more to that, but that is part of it, so that you are likely to see the contradictions and accept the contradictions. And that you're likely to just be aware of changes, that if something is negative now, it may be positive later. If something is positive now, it may be negative later.
Yeah.
So those type of ideas. But bottom line, the argument is not really about, I mean, the argument is about like where the cultural differences kind of come about.
Yeah.
And thus it becomes more of the question of, well, these people, they are brought up in this kind of dialectical culture of Taoism or Buddhism, even though those are really different. But like, okay, if you put them together, so take this kind of very big picture view, they are much more accepting of this type of dialectical ideas than some of the Christian ethics that you would find in the West. Of course, that would not explain why you would find, for instance, similar patterns in Hong Kong, where there are many more Christians, or in Korea, where 40% of the population is Christian, or even more right now. So that was, for us, it was a contentious issue. It was like there was not enough evidence, and it just didn't know. So it was like, let's test it. And there was another hypothesis that it's about the also very prevalent in the literature, and it's not about these beliefs themselves, but about how people are attuned to social environments. So in some of the cultures, you have a greater tendency to focus on the group you live in, on your family, on your friends, and so on, and to be really attuned to them, and in fact define yourself through your relationships with these people. And that is not necessarily a tendency you find in the West. In the West, you find a tendency to be much more self-focused. I mean, you define your friends through their relationship towards you. It's like you pick your friends depending on how similar they are to you, and so on and so forth. So it's all in a way we live in a society of ever increasing individualism and self-focus, both in North America and in Great Britain, as similar tendencies have been observed.
And presumably we in the West see that we generate emotions ourselves, that it comes from within rather than more that it stems from an interaction with your environment and other people.
That's correct. So that's the sort of like as an extension of this idea that it is all about you, and you have this kind of internal essence.
Yeah.
That is driving you. The emotions are part of this internal essence. They originate in the body, and then maybe the environment will come later. Whereas most of the emotion researchers would say that's not really what happens. It's emotions are constructed. Emotions are they emerge when you start interacting with the environment. You have some kind of impulses in your body, but they are not really super defined until you have this interaction.
Okay.
And so that's why we thought that maybe this would be another way to explain if there are any cultural differences, that this kind of tendency to focus on the self versus focus on others may be another parallel process.
So that was your hypothesis, yeah. So how did you actually go about setting the research up? Am I right that you divide it into three main stages, didn't you?
Yeah, we had several studies. The first study, we didn't try to cover everything in every single study, in part because it's almost impossible. In the first stage, we looked at the actual narratives that exist already online. There was a database that was created by somebody else for linguistic purposes. And it was a database of English language texts, online texts, including half of the texts were blogs of people. So they were all in English, which is very nice because it allows to control for language.
Yeah.
And yet they were coming from a large number of countries. So they were coming from 10 different countries. In fact, he collected data from 20 countries, but some of them, either English was not the main language or the very small percent of the population was speaking it, or people didn't have much internet access. So we decided not to include them, like Jamaica, for instance. And instead of that, we focused on 10 countries, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Ireland, Great Britain, United States, Philippines, and I think we also had Malaysia. So we had countries where you have a large number of our population that can still speak English, including some of them as first, like Singapore, for instance, as a first language, and yet be surrounded by very different cultural environment. And so what we did in that study, we looked at the texts and we tried to identify, okay, if you have in a sentence positive and negative words, adjectives that are very close to each other and are connected by words like and but. So that would indicate that the sentence has this kind of ambivalent mixed tone to it. So it has, for instance, you can have friendly and upset or something like that. This is kind of imaginary construction, probably not super likely. But bottom line is, so we looked at the text and we just counted how many percentage-wise of the narratives, how many sentences are there in the corpus, so in the texts from Singapore, Malaysia, Philippines, Hong Kong, and other countries, the sort of English-speaking countries, and compared those. And we found that in Southeast Asia and partially in South Africa, you have a greater proportion of this mixed sentences than in Anglo-Saxon sort of influenced texts.
Okay.
So that was the first study. And then we went further and said, okay, now we looked at the corpus, but how about now we extend this to both other forms of complexity and actually look at people's subjective reports. So we had a large survey in which people reported on their daily experiences. And for they were mundane experiences, like being stuck in the traffic jam, looking at yourself in the mirror, reading a book. And for each of those, people reported different emotions.
Yeah.
And we were able to calculate both the ability to differentiate between different aspects of the emotions and the mixture, positive and negative.
Okay.
And we did that in I think six different countries, in Germany, in the UK, it was Britain in particular, in the US, in Russia, in India, and in Japan.
Okay. And what age were the people you were studying, roughly?
So in the second study, this were college students.
Okay.
Which is why in the last study, there we zeroed in specifically on the US and Japan, where we found quite reliable differences in the second study. Across different metrics. And all of those metrics, by the way, India and Japan, and to some extent Russia. No, Russia and Germany were kind of in between, depending on the metric. But India and Japan were quite often on the one end. They were higher in terms of differentiating negative experiences reporting mixture of positive and negative experiences than the British and the American sample, and to some extent the German sample. So in the last study, we looked at age heterogeneous samples of Americans and Japanese. So these are people between the ages of 25 and 75.
Right.
And again, we found substantial differences between them. What we also found is, and this is something we measured in different ways, in different studies, we looked at these tendencies of, for instance, on the culture level, that's the proportion of people who are adhering to sort of a dialectical belief system in a country. Does this correspond to the magnitude of complexity? It turns out not at all.
Interesting.
How about this type of tendency to be more individualist? And again, we looked either at the cultural metrics or we looked at the individual metrics in the last study. It turns out that that was much more aligned with the ability, with both cultural variability and individual level variability. And particularly, it was the tendency to be sensitive to social information. So if you see, so if you're more attuned to social information, those were the people who were more likely to sort of report both positive and negative at the same time.
Okay, so what you're saying then is key is the degree to which people, when you say social information, which people can focus on other people rather than simply themselves?
Yes, yes. So, I mean, we did not find much evidence for, I mean, there is this idea, it's like, is it about the self itself? So, and some people talk about it then in terms of so-called, it's a jargon term, self-construal. How do you construe yourself? How do you think about yourself? It turns out that that didn't really matter that much. If you think about yourself in more sort of interdependent terms or independent terms, that did not matter. What did matter is like if you're behaviorally more sensitive to, let's say, changes in vocal tone or more sensitive to memories that involve, like when you recall something, do you recall the social information or do you recall just some kind of key information that does not really describe the social environment? And so this tendency of being socially attuned, like be socially sensitive, was related to the ability to differentiate and report both positive and negative.
Okay, so given now that the East emotional complexity seems to be a good thing, and your research seems to bear that out, maybe this is more going into maybe what your opinion is now, or maybe your work in the Wisdom and Research Lab. Go. So how, if we have a certain lack of it in the West, how do we go about cultivating it?
Well, as you just pointed out, this is probably more my speculation. So first of all, I need to point out that certainly for emotional complexity, we still don't know how beneficial that is. So this is actually the paradox.
Okay.
We don't know yet if these tendencies, of which it seems like people in Japan and Southeast Asia and to some extent in Russia have more of than people in the West, we don't know if they are actually more beneficial for those people. So that research is missing. We are currently planning to do a large-scale study to address this question, actually a set of studies, because I'm really interested in this topic. But I cannot really speak to the sort of the functionality outside of the Western context. What is paradoxical is like that in the West, even though it is beneficial, people think it is not and, in fact, prefer not to do it. So that's the interesting part. But I would not I would hesitate of generalizing and saying that this is something that everybody should be doing because we simply don't know enough yet. Now, let's assume for a second that it is beneficial for everybody. Now, what would be the strategies? Well, we found that in some of our work, more in the domain of reasoning, but also to some extent in the domain of this more complex balanced representation, that taking a step back and looking at yourself from some kind of a third-person fly-on-the-wall vantage point seems to be beneficial. So people who do that, are more likely to report the emotions in a more balanced and less extreme way. So they report both more emotions, they report them in a more balanced fashion instead of just emphasizing anger, for instance, in negative experiences. So that's sort of preliminary one step into that direction. The same strategy, by the way, also works for increasing your wisdom when you're reasoning about interpersonal conflicts. Now, I'm not sure if it's actually increasing the wisdom. Let me take that back. Because I do think that we all have the capacity for reasoning in a complex fashion, in this kind of integrative fashion, and also the capacity for recognizing multiple emotions. So what is more likely to happen is that there are situations in our lives that prevent us from doing so. And it is more about the ways to sort of circumnavigate those situations and make sure that this we recognize them. So like and particularly self-serving situations seem to be driving this tendency. So like in the self-serving situations, when it's all about you, about personal interests, people are somehow less likely to both recognize the diversity of the emotions and to reason in a sort of integrative fashion.
Okay, now that makes sense. And what about certain integrative practices, like, you know, you were talking about it's helpful to build awareness. Things like meditation, for example, or mindfulness, do you see that as something as useful? Or engagements in the arts where you... Again, that's something where you can arguably cultivate a greater sense of ambiguity and differentiation.
That's possible. I mean, again, this is very speculative because there's not enough research on that. But I can imagine that some forms of meditation and certainly some forms of mindfulness meditation work on similar principles of In mindfulness meditation, people talk of decentering, like stepping away from your immediate and usual way how you perceive the world. And this tendency is very similar, almost by default defined as this type of tendency of self-distancing, looking at yourself from this kind of fly on the wall perspective.
Yeah. Okay.
So there is a great deal of similarity with respect to art. Well, there are multiple processes at play. It could be that it helps you to just distance yourself. It could also be that this, quite often when you see beautiful art, you have this experience of awe that helps you to transcend the immediate surrounding again. And that may also be another process that may work similarly to self-distancing. Again, we don't know enough yet, but it is possible, and it's very exciting doing research in this topic.
I can imagine, Igor. And is that your next step, you think?
Yeah, I mean, there are two directions and if with respect to this particular project. One of them is indeed to try to understand a bit more about the functionality in across cultures, as well as understand the process that may facilitate or inhibit this tendency to sort of recognize your emotions in a complex fashion.
Yeah.
So we have a few projects going along those lines. I mean, the other issue that I'm trying to understand and sort of get a better insight about is, what is the relationship between this type of emotional process and then the reflective processes that that are commonly described as wisdom, sort of like wise judgment? Like under what circumstances do these emotions benefit or inhibit wise judgment? And that's also something that has been grappled in philosophy for decades, centuries, but has not been really addressed in an empirical fashion. So that's what my lab is working on now.
Oh, it sounds very intriguing, Igor. Well, just my last couple of questions. The middle way, as we understand it, Igor, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, whether those are beliefs are positive or negative. That then throws us back on experience, so we're left in the messy, uncertain middle. But it's arguably in the messy, uncertain middle that we actually start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, that's a good question. So, I mean, the idea of I think it very much resonates with the notion of wisdom in the interpersonal domain. And why am I saying that right away? Is because I think I do think evolutionary, of course, if you believe in cultural evolution, for instance, or how societies evolve, sort of morphs, so it's got a big picture perspective.
Yeah.
For the society to function, for a group of, let's say, over 200 people, it may not be a bad idea to have a system of beliefs, because without a system of beliefs, ideals, it's very hard to explain why larger groups of people would cooperate.
But
that aside, like on the interpersonal level, like it's like we talk about smaller groups, so under 150 or so. I do think, and for personal decisions, I think there it does make perfect sense to think of the notion of integration and the notion of accepting uncertainty and recognizing that many ideas are indeed uncertain by default, and that's nothing wrong with having them be uncertain.
Yeah.
Like uncertain in terms of emotional experiences, it's not just black or white.
Sure.
Uncertain in terms of how to act, it's not just reward or punishment. That is just an essence of human life. It's like thinking in terms of probabilistic tendencies, in terms of probabilities, instead of in terms of definite answers, is something that we evolved doing, and unconsciously, humans, we do all the time.
Yeah.
It's just sometimes we forget about it.
Yeah, well, I could agree with that. There you go. Anyway, well, thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been really enjoyable, very interesting, and I'm going to follow your future research with much interest. It sounds fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.